Spit and Twitches is part of the Thunderbird 6 podcasting network.
Drinking beer in the morning.
All right, so finally decided to do this. I've been talking about it on Facebook, Twitter, Google Plus, and really exciting blog, GabeBroadbeck.com. I've talked about the idea of doing an animal cognition podcast. Part of this is, what's the word I'm looking for? I guess inspired by Futures in Biotech with Mark Peltier. And if you should check that, even if you don't know a lot about biotech. It's fun, and Mark's a good guy. So the idea is I'm going to talk to people in animal cognition. So the name of the show, unless someone comes up with a better name, is Spit and Twitches, which is a reference to something I think Bob Rescorla said, right, in a paper. It's more than just spit and twitches, I think. And this is the, we'll call it episode zero, with a pilot episode. And I'm sitting here with one of my colleagues here at Algoma University, Lori Bloomfield. How's it going, Lori?
I'm doing very well. How are you, Dave?
Okay.
Good.
So, like I said, the idea here is we're just going to talk about the kind of stuff you've done, the kind of stuff you're doing, etc. Before we get going, how did you get into studying bird communication?
Well, it was kind of an accident, actually. When I was an undergrad here at Algoma University, I took a few courses with a few no-names, one being Dave Broadbeck. And, you know yourself, you talk a lot about animal research because it's really interesting, it's exciting. And what really attracted me was the unique type of methodology required in order to answer the questions that you had. So with human research, which, not that there's anything wrong with it, but... If you want an answer, sometimes you just have to ask the question.
Yes, exactly.
Unfortunately, most non-human animals don't speak our language. In fact, I don't know of any that do at this point.
Now that Alex is dead, right?
Yeah, that's right. Unfortunately, that's
sad.
A sad thing.
That is sad. It's
yes. So I thought, well, this is interesting. Let's learn about the methodologies required to ask some questions. And my first interest was in spatial cognition, of course, spatial navigation.
Yeah.
Because that's what I knew most about. That's what you spoke of.
Because somebody told you
exactly,
all about it.
Exactly,
yeah, sure,
yes. Exactly. So I investigated that a little bit further. And then when applying to grad schools, I came across Queen's University and the option to look at animal communication.
Right.
And that kind of brought me back to my initial problem. I couldn't just ask the animals for the answer to the questions I had. So perhaps if I learned more about their ways of communication, ultimately I could find better ways to ask them.
Right.
So that's sort of how I got into... animal communication.
So I mean, you think it was more about the challenge of it in a lot of respects than at the beginning, the challenge of it rather than the content itself.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the content was interesting. Don't get me wrong.
Oh, yeah, sure.
It all depended on what we were doing. I understood that, you know, it was very natural for rats to run along the sides of walls and in the basements of houses. Not in this city, of course. But,
no.
But you know, so it was understood that they would. Very easily go through a radial arm maze, and so to me that was interesting, but it wasn't a challenge for me. I wanted something that took a little bit more skill, a little bit more technique,
okay,
in order to test some of the questions.
Neat. So when you started your undergrad, you didn't think at all about going on in psych or anything like that?
Not even a little bit. No, not even a bit. The reason I started out as an undergraduate is because I was working in a bar and I was really sick and tired of it. I really thought maybe there's got to be something better out there for me.
Yeah.
So I took a summer course here at the university, and really without putting a whole lot of effort into it, I did fairly well. So I thought, geez, imagine what I could do if I put some effort into it. So,
that's awesome.
So I started full-time in the fall after being off high school, out of high school for about 4 or 5 years.
Right.
And what really captured my interest in psychology was the brain chapter in Intro Psych.
Nice.
I thought, how cool is this?
Yeah.
Because I knew absolutely nothing about it. So just the fact that I was learning something that was so fascinating just drove me to continue learning.
And of course now you teach Intro for us.
I do, yes, and I teach that brain and behavior chapter, and hopefully some students also find it interesting and fascinating as well.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
And then you went on, you worked with Ron Wiseman for your master's degree at Queen's, right?
Indeed.
What were you working on there?
Well, that's where I started out with the animal communication. Ron was very well established in his
sure.
field of animal communication, And what was really nice about going there and working with Ron was that within the first couple of weeks, I had gained some skills working with the microscope. I'd been looking at brain sections under the microscope.
Nice.
So within weeks, I had gained a new skill. And then he had given me that time to think about what I would be interested in doing. He did not assign me a project. I came in knowing very little about the area, and he said, well, what do you want to do? I said, well, you know what? I am really interested in the fact that there's two very closely related species of birds. I wonder if they understand each other's language, each other's vocal signals. Talking about the Carolina and black-capped chickadees,
right.
Because in some regions, they not only sort of live sympatrically, but they might also interbreed. So to me,
really?
That was,
okay.
Yeah, so that was really interesting to me. So I thought, there's got to be something similar about their vocalizations between these two species in order for them to get along so well in the same habitat and to engage in hybridization.
Right.
So I said, let's do something with that. And of course, he had the techniques, he had the technology, he
sure.
had the equipment to do some opera conditioning.
Grant money.
And the money, of course,
yeah.
Yes, to do opera conditioning. So we started out with a bioacoustic analysis because to describe first is to vine. And to experiment second is the way to go, right?
Yeah.
So we had to describe the vocalizations.
Okay.
And then we had to test it and
you
see.
Okay. Just calls or just songs or both?
Just the calls. The difference between the calls and songs is that songs are used only by males, most
yeah.
typically, and only during about one time of the year. This is just before breeding season. The calls give us a much broader range of communication
mm-hmm.
signals because many species produce many different types of calls. And recent evidence suggests that some of them are even learned. The fact that the birds are expending so much energy and brain resources to learning these vocalizations suggests that there's something important about them.
Yeah.
And so the calls are produced year-round
yeah.
and by both males and females. So
yeah.
it provides us with a broader sample to study and potentially a highly functional vocalization.
And you found that... Did they actually understand each other, the two?
Well, what we did find was that there were some similarities, similar enough that we could call them, the calls, virtually the same thing.
Yeah.
You could say that perhaps one had an accent. I used to say that Carolina chickadees sound just like black-capped chickadees, but on speed.
Yeah.
If I can do a rendition, a black-capped chickadee is chickadee-dee-dee-dee,
yeah.
whereas a Carolina chickadee was chickadee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee.
Okay.
So it was much more sped up. The fact that I, as a human, could tell the difference between the two of them, it was not surprising that the black-capped chickadees could
yes.
also distinguish between the two of them. But one of the interesting things that I was able to point to in this study was that they could not only distinguish between the two species' calls, but they could also memorize individual
yeah.
calls of the other species.
Yeah, I remember this stuff. Yeah.
So, I mean, that was pretty interesting. It's a completely different species. They perhaps had no real reason to individually identify different birds' calls, but they were quite able to do so.
Mm-hmm.
So that was just, you know, one small yes. piece of the puzzle that we found.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. I've always said that boreal chickadees sound like black-capped chickadees that smoke players' planes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Chickadee-dee-dee.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a whole different thing.
Yeah.
And of course, marsh tits, they just go like this, chickadee-dee-dee. That's a really inside joke. If anybody gets that, my email address is dave.broadbeck@algoma.ca. There's no prize involved, but see if you can figure that one out. Now, then you went on, of course, to Alberta, University of Alberta, and you worked for your PhD. You were, I think, probably the first PhD student from another Wiseman student, Chris Sturdy, right?
Absolutely, yes. Chris graduated with his PhD from Ron Wiseman's lab at Queen's in 2000, I believe, which was the year, or maybe 1999, which was just before I had arrived, so I had not met him. He had just left the lab.
I thought you were, okay, I always figured you knew him. Okay.
No, I didn't, but he was the one who was, he was at Duke University
yep.
in North Carolina doing his postdoc. He was the one that gathered the recordings of the Carolina chickadees in North Carolina
okay.
for me.
He was working with Jeff Sinks, right?
No, he was working with, Noonan. Mooney.
Yes.
Mooney.
Okay.
Yeah, and so he collected the recordings for me. He started at the U of A in September of 2002?
I think that's right.
And I started there in July, August, September, I guess it would be, of the following year.
Okay.
So I can't believe it's been that long. My memory fails me. I don't even know what year it is right now. I still think it's 2010 sometimes.
Yeah. The world ends in 2012 anyway. So
there we go. So I don't have to, I only have to count for another year. Yeah. So I was his first PhD student. I joined the lab with a fellow master's student from BC.
Okay.
And she and I together helped to put his lab together, get it up and running, get the operant chambers together, decide where the desks would go and how many computers we needed. So it was a real lot of fun. I basically was responsible for setting up a lab years before I would eventually get my own lab. So
yeah.
I've got some experience in that. So yeah, it was a great opportunity for Chris too to have somebody come in, because I had just taken down the Ron Wiseman's lab. Ron retired at Queen's the year I went to work with him.
Right.
So he went to Florida. There goes my supervisor off to Florida, and left me with the lab.
So you kind of had your own lab as a first-year master's student.
First-year master's student.
Very few
of us
can say that.
Yes, exactly, yes. And so when I was done there, I was his last grad student, when I was done there, he was giving all of his equipment to Chris Sturdy. So I was responsible for taking all of the equipment down, packing it all up, getting it into a moving van, and driving it across the country to Alberta. So I did that. Came home, finished up what I had to do, went back there, and proceeded to put it all back together again.
That's awesome.
So
I never knew that story.
So I took the equipment down and I put it all back together again. So I know how the stuff works.
I guess so.
Yeah.
And what did you do for your PhD? What was your PhD stuff about?
PhD stuff was very similar to my master's stuff. I'm still very much interested in interspecific communication, obviously,
mm-hmm.
because I want to communicate with the animals. I want to be able to ask them questions eventually and get the answers.
Yeah.
But right now I'm working on what they're dealing with their own vocal signals with other species. So much like my master's degree, which was with black-capped and Carolina chickadees, I had the opportunity to work with the mountain chickadees out in the mountains.
Right.
So I spent many, many winters hanging out in the mountains and recording mountain chickadees out there, collecting the birds, bringing them back to the lab. And very same thing, I was looking to see, could they discriminate between each other's vocalizations,
mm-hmm.
and to what level, to what degree, how fine were their perceptual abilities, and what parts of the vocal signal of the calls were they most paying attention to?
Right.
So what was the species-specific marker in the vocalization?
So there's basically, with a lot of these bird call kind of, this bird call stuff, even bird song stuff, is it like this one like little phrase? I don't know what the technical term is, but like one little note, one little phrase, whatever you want to call it, that's what they key in on, and the rest of it is basically just fluff? Or?
Well, that's partly it. So if you think about a chickadee call, the chicka part are really high frequency notes, and the D part is the one we recognize, D, D, D,
yeah,
D.
Yeah, sure.
And it's that D, D, D part that differs between all of the species. So like the Carolina chickadee has the D, D, D on speed.
Yes.
The mountain chickadee sounds like... they've got something in their throat, they go dee, dee, dee.
Right.
And so I, as a human, that's how I would distinguish between the two species. And
yeah.
Sure enough, when I asked the birds themselves, using awesome techniques, that's exactly what they told me as well,
right.
is that they're relying on that dee, dee, dee part. Now, does that mean that the introductory chicka part of the chickadee call is fluff? Probably not. And so my research program now is trying to identify
yeah.
what is the purpose of that introductory part. We know that they can use some of those features for individual recognition.
Okay.
So the start frequency of the chicka part, for example,
mm-hmm.
They also have terms ABC notes.
Yep.
The start frequency will differ, for example, between individuals, which could help you identify one bird from another. But what my program now is going to look at is whether, in fact, this introductory part is conveying a particular message,
mm-hmm.
not just trying to convey information regarding identity, species, individual, sex, but a particular message such as there's a particular type of food available, there's
okay.
a particular threat or predator nearby,
mm-hmm.
There's a lot of food available or very little, so the quality and quantity of food types. Do they alter it depending on who their audience is? So do they have a particular phrase or set of note types they use when their mate's nearby? Obviously somebody that they want to help
right.
versus when it's a stranger. So I don't think the introductory part's fluff, but at this point we don't know exactly what
okay.
it does.
So you think it has some kind of function though?
It has to. Why would they expend the energy
Fair enough.
Conveying it, right?
Fair
they
enough.
Could just go DDD if that's all they need.
Yeah, I was thinking of that because when I remember... to this day, whenever I hear a chickadee, my head turns because it's like I have flashbacks to graduate school.
Sure.
I remember often hearing when I was first in Sarah Shuttleworth's lab, and we had, of course, chickadees everywhere, and I would hear dee dee dee, but no chicka at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking, is there something wrong with this bird?
Because
I mean, I didn't know song, call, and nothing.
Yeah.
I was 23 years old and I was an idiot. So I would think, there's something wrong with the birds. They're not singing properly. Because mm-hmm. Now I know that's not a song. The song is the Phoebe thing.
Yep.
But I remember thinking, you know, what are we doing? And then I realized, oh, I see. Those aren't, God, I don't know. Who the hell did I ask? I think it was our lab tech, Andrew. And I said, you know, it's funny. The birds sound kind of funny. They're just saying dee, dee, dee. And he said, well, yeah. I said, but aren't they supposed to all be the same? He said, no, the you know, that's always the same.
Yeah.
But and of course, that even isn't. That's a whole other area of research.
Yeah.
But I remember hearing that the dee, 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 dee sometimes. And then sometimes you hear just dee, dee.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you hear dee, 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 dee.
Mm-hmm.
Like really strange. But it turns out, in fact, because of course you know more than I, that this is something that they do differ a little bit, and there's a lot more. Is there a lot more range in call than song, or because song seems so much more sort of like more stereotyped compared to call. Like bird calls seem a lot more have a lot wider range. Is that true, or am I just talking to my ass here?
Yeah, I mean it depends on the species, right? I mean we're talking about chickadees. Chickadees have one song. That's
yeah,
it.
That's
and
right.
In fact, in the boreal chickadee, they don't even have a song. So there's, yeah, I know.
Really?
So there's the question as to whether the chickadee call or the other vocalization, the gargle call, which sounds like something like that, not a very good rendition of it, whether one of those two function as the song in boreal chickadees. So something else I hope to investigate now that I'm back here in Ontario. Boreal chickadees just live north of the city. So something else that I'll be looking at as well. But chickadees just have the other species of chickadees have just the one song, whereas they have up to about 12 to 14 different call types. Other call types that I've looked at is the seat call. Now, this is a call that most people wouldn't even hear, but
mm-hmm.
I hear it quite readily in the bush. It sounds like
psst, psst. Oh, I know that one. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. And what it seems to be is a male and female, for example, just staying in touch with one another.
Nice.
And we've shown that, in fact, there are differences between the species, that this call is learned,
mm-hmm.
and that they can also use it to identify individuals and the sex of the bird.
Wow.
So a paper just came out. The lead author on that is Lauren Gallette, who's currently working in Chris Doherty's lab. So we've looked at the development of this seat call. And like I said, there's the gargle call. The gargle call is really cool, too, because like the chickadee call, it contains anywhere between 3 and 15 note types that can be repeated or omitted from the call.
Okay.
The chickadee call, you think that's complex. It contains, you know, 5, 6, 7 note types. Gargle call's twice that big.
Really?
And twice as complex with its variability and frequency and duration modulations. So it's definitely a more difficult one to look at. But it was looked at many years ago. Millicent Ficken is a very famous name when it comes to studying chickadee vocalizations. And she did do an analysis of it. And there's been other species that have been, you know, had a cursory look at their gargle vocalizations. But what we tried to do in the Sturdy Lab, even though a lot of bioacoustic analyses, a lot of descriptive analyses had been done on these chickadee calls,
mm-hmm.
the methods were never the same. The equipment was never the same.
Sure.
The standards, I'm not going to say the standards weren't there, they just were not consistent across species. What we wanted to do, what I wanted to do, obviously, at looking at interspecific communication, was to make direct comparisons. And I couldn't do that without going back to square one, recording them with the same equipment, analyzing them using the exact same methods and techniques and equipment, and then going from there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it kind of seems like we've done some repetitive work. Yes, the species were looked at, but it had to be done.
Of course. I mean, there's something that, and there's really something you said for that. I mean, I remember that one of the things that always got me when I was a postdoc with Bill Roberts was that Bill Roberts is and was the king of varying parameters. Like he was the most, I can't say he's the most careful scientist I've ever worked with, because Sarah Shuttle was pretty freaking careful.
Yeah.
But he had a methodical way of doing things that at times almost seemed like drudgery. I mean, I've described it to students that research a lot of times is and this is obviously a bit of a stretch, but it's like I've heard soldiers describe combat. It's hours and hours of boredom punctuated by moments of sheer terror. And I mean, I found that, I remember in Bill's lab, and then I appreciated it a lot more when I worked with him, is
mm-hmm.
that, you know, you have to do this.
Yes.
As much as it may not be everything's a breakthrough, and Bill Roberts has his share of breakthroughs,
mm-hmm.
Or for Bill Roberts, we probably wouldn't be having a little animal cognition podcast here. But I think looking at that kind of stuff is really important. And I think that, and I personally, I think a lot of people really ignore that.
Yeah.
I don't mean that researchers ignore it. I think it doesn't get published as readily because people don't want to publish 7 experiment papers.
Mm-hmm.
Then we change this. Then we change this.
Yes.
Then we change this. You know, and I understand that.
Yeah.
It's just that that stuff does have to get done.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, as much as I'd love to just run out to the bush right now and start playing back things and writing it all down and publishing it.
That's not science.
It's not science.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's just, goofing around in mere observation pretty
yeah.
much. So yeah, absolutely. I've got a student in my lab right now who's been plucking away all summer long at reading every paper she can get her hands on.
Nice.
In order to get the exact methodology down the first time. Yeah, you always have to make a little tweak here and there, but as long as it's little tweaks and not big ones that require you to start the experiment over again, that's all right with me. But I understand the drudgery. I went through a lot of it. Chris Sturdy definitely was attentive to details.
Mm-hmm.
And if he wasn't and noticed a detail later on, he wouldn't hesitate to tell you to start over again, start
yeah.
from scratch. So I learned that from him, that I paid such attention to detail that I wrote everything down in notebooks.
Oh, yeah.
Tons of notebooks and even my data. I mean, when I was taking measurements of particular vocalizations, I'd measure the start frequency and I'd write it down. I had spreadsheets written, handwritten, hundreds and hundreds of pages of them that I would then transcribe into the computer. But I wanted that hard copy with me in case something happened. And so I always carried around a little notebook with me to write things down and ideas and something somebody would say. So when I graduated from the U of A, of course, what did I get from Sturdy as a graduation gift? Was a nice new leather-bound notebook.
Very nice.
Yes. Figured I needed to upgrade my notebook to a new one.
I had a little micro cassette player recorder.
Oh, that's handy.
I used that because Twin Peaks was on TV and I wanted to be just like Richard Cooper. But in fact, I figured out how to analyze my PhD data while sitting in a bath. And I jumped out of the bathtub and I grabbed the thing and I said, oh, there's like a version of Chi-Squared you can use. Seriously. And I came up with the idea of my PhD thesis walking down the street.
Really?
And walking down Spadina Avenue, people looked at me like I was an idiot. I was talking into this little recorder.
Uh-huh.
We could actually look at what the birds are remembering, not how much. It's really weird, and you're right, things come to you like that.
Yeah.
And the detail thing, you mentioned that. Sarah was like that too.
Yeah.
Every day you looked at your data.
Mm-hmm.
And you always had it graphed out. Every single damn day. And it used to drive me nuts. And I realized, probably later on in my graduate school career, that what she was doing was really smart. Because, there were times when we caught big mistakes that either of us had made.
Mm-hmm.
More typically me.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I became postdoc in Bill's lab, I remember when I was supervising Mike Boisvert. Every day we'd look at the data, every single damn day. And I'm pretty sure it drove him nuts, but eventually I think it made sense to him too. So.
Yeah, for sure.
You were talking about what you're doing now, and you've got, you don't have to blow your own horn because I will. You've got a nice big insert grant now. And you got that, 2 years ago?
Kicked in last year. May, so I'm 1 year in.
Woohoo!
Yes.
So thank you to the good NSERC. We love NSERC. Are you working? You're working on similar kinds of stuff now?
I am. Yeah. There's a lot of questions that, of course, come up. Anytime you do a good experiment, a good research study, it should come. It should
yes.
produce several more questions. So there are some questions that I do want to have answered still that come out of my PhD research. That I'm hoping once I get my lab set up here with operant conditioning chambers, I can continue to collaborate with Chris Sturdy out west,
sure.
who also has operant conditioning chambers. We can both run the same study simultaneously,
yeah.
Get it out pretty quickly, and of course, because these ideas come from studies that I did working with him, he has part ownership to them as well. So
fair
he may
enough,
as well
yeah.
he may as well put a little work into it as well.
Yeah, Sturdy doesn't work hard enough, and
yeah,
that's something I don't like about him. I think he's a lazy bastard, and
sure.
he bothers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so I'm going to put him to work. Well, more like put his students to work.
Yes, of course.
Yes, sorry, Sturdy Lab. So that's the hope, is to try to figure out. One of the questions I have is, we know that the birds individually identify each other based on their vocalizations.
Yes.
So if I play Bob's chickadee call,
yes.
the bird will recognize it.
Yes.
But the question I have is, can they transfer this over to Bob's song? Bob's Gargle Call,
nice.
And Bob's Seat. So I have a little bit of interest in observational learning and transitive inference.
Yeah.
So this is where this sort of this idea comes from. If I recognize your voice saying one word,
mm-hmm.
do I also recognize that as being Dave when you say another word
okay.
or another vocalization?
Yeah.
So that's one of the first things that we're working on. But the main goal of my research program is to find out what that fluff is, as you called it,
yeah.
in the chickadee call. There's got to be a reason why they're repeating these note types or omitting them entirely. When you listen to a bird, sometimes if you're just sitting down at a picnic table in the park and you hear a bird, it'll often repeat the same call over and over
yeah.
and over again. Why is it repeating that exact same call? It must be trying to convey some kind of a message, whereas if the bird flies away or changes its perch locations, it'll change its call
yes.
type to different notes. So my idea is I'm hoping to try to figure out exactly, well, not even exactly, just somewhat
mm-hmm.
what it is they're trying to convey. Recent evidence came out, great study done by Chris Templeton and published in Science back in 2005, I believe it was, found that the birds change up the number of D notes in their call depending on the threat of the predator. So smaller predators, smaller hawks,
mm-hmm.
are a higher threat. Because they can swoop in and,
okay, yeah, sure.
and chase the birds better. So the birds would produce, I believe, more D notes in their call when it was a higher threat predator, seemingly to notify all
okay.
their flock mates and kin that there was a threat.
And the flocks, they're related? I mean, that's typically your...
The flocks?
Yeah.
No. No. When birds have their brood, the nestlings will fledge.
Okay.
They usually stay within about 5 kilometers of their natal territory.
Okay.
But the flocks usually consist of mated pairs, 2 to 4 to 6 mated pairs.
Okay.
And the mated pairs are usually mates for life.
Yeah.
But we do know evidence from Dan Metal and Lorene Radcliffe and their work, both back at Queen's University, and Dan now at University of Windsor, that the birds will engage in extra pair matings, and so they'll cheat on their spouse.
Yeah.
And they'll also divorce their spouse.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some interesting natural behaviors in the birds as well as vocalizations.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So they're much more like humans than most people realize.
is there other stuff in besides communication stuff that you've been interested in? Or?
Yeah, I still have that love for spatial cognition and. One of the things I want to know about is, are they also conveying information regarding the location of food? This comes from the classic work of von Frisch and the
oh, yes.
dance of the honeybees.
Oh yeah, classic.
Yeah, so the bees are conveying information about the location of food.
Mm-hmm.
Do other animals do it? They probably do.
Yeah.
We just have to figure out what
the
that communication signal is. So I want to know if they are able to communicate the location of food. So this can be done in the laboratory, for example, if we can find there's different vocalizations that they are indeed using when I set up different feeders out in the bush. Can I use those vocalizations to guide an animal towards a particular
mm-hmm.
location in the laboratory? So you can imagine very much like a Ken Cheng setup.
Yep.
A box with a perch in each of the four corners,
mm-hmm.
one of the four corners baited. If I play a particular vocalization that I think, based on bioacoustic analysis, is correlated with a particular location of food, will the bird then go to that location?
Right.
It sounds all simple when I put it down into one or two sentences, but it's going to take years to get
there. Oh, yes.
No, unfortunately.
Actually, wheels are turning here.
Yes.
You're sitting here trying to think of things, and yeah, there's a lot of, we were talking before about varying parameters and all this
yeah.
sort of drudgery kind of work.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a whole other insert.
That's
right
a whole
there.
Other research program almost, yes.
Yeah.
But the work is being started on it now. Our colleague here at Dalgoma, Jennifer Foote, has some great recording equipment. She also works with birds
yeah.
in the field. So she's got some recording equipment that I'm gonna try out and see if it works, that allows me to just set it up and walk away and record the birds. So I am going to put up, for example, couple different feeders in a 50 meter, you know, sort of radius, so apart from one another, and see if there are different vocalizations at the different feeders,
mm-hmm.
to see if they're conveying and have the same food types in them. So I'll know the vocalizations, they won't be conveying something about the quality or quantity of food. They'll have to be vocalizing about something else. So that's one place to start, to see if they're communicating something about location of food. So we are out there, we're getting recording, and you know, we're doing the legwork, we're doing the drudgery.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's all fun and games.
When you look back on your career so far, which, I mean, it's, you know, you're what, 6 years in here? This is your sixth year?
I'm starting my
starting
fifth.
Starting your, yeah. Okay.
Starting my fifth.
Okay. So you're like, you're starting out assistant professor kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything you would tell an undergraduate student or a starting out graduate student that you think, one piece of advice you think you could give them?
Learn a technique and learn it well. You can always fall back on one technique. If things don't work out for you in the long run, for example, I know how to do bioacoustic analyses on the computer, I know how to do operant conditioning, I know how to do some neurophysiological stuff, I know how to do some spatial cognition stuff. But if everything fell apart and I had absolutely no money, no space, and no time, all I had in front of me was a computer, I could still get research done.
Right.
I could still get out there, record some birds, even if it was just with my iPod or something.
Yes.
I could still get something done. So it's great to learn a lot of techniques, and that's what you do in graduate school.
Yeah.
You learn a lot of techniques, and if you choose to go off into a postdoc, the idea is to learn yet another new technique. And I was given an NSERC to do neurophysiology in bats.
Yeah.
But I turned it down for the position
for the job
here.
Yeah,
yes. To learn, again, yet another technique. But I felt at that time that I was skilled enough in the two techniques that I knew I had down rock
mm-hmm.
solid, bioacoustic analyses and operant conditioning, and I had my fingers in other techniques as well that I could rely on others about. So one piece of advice would be, learn a technique and know it well. Be the expert at that technique.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't just give one piece of advice, of course, because I can't stop there. The second piece of advice I would...
Hey, whose show is this?
Hey,
apparently
it's mine right now.
Apparently.
I would say to, fall back on your collaborators. Trust in your collaborators, the people that you meet. I do know how to do neurophysiology. Would I just start up my own lab and start running it right now, start processing brains? No, probably not. I would certainly get back in touch with the people who had taught me, people who do it now, people who have done it much more extensively than I have. So I'm comfortable in being able to say, I don't have that skill down. But I do know the people who do. So trust in your collaborators and trust in your colleagues and don't be afraid to pick up the phone and call them.
Yeah, I think that's something that a lot of people, most people that do this, do what we do, understand that that science is actually a very social activity.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the general public actually gets that at all. They
no.
think that we all sit in our laboratories quietly scheming and trying to scoop each other's papers and get them out.
Yeah.
Whereas really what you're doing, how often do people have single author publications?
Yeah, very
rarely. They're very rare.
Yeah.
They're usually earlier in your career. I have a couple of those because both Sarah and then Bill Roberts said, you should have one with just your name on it. It's good for your CV.
Wow.
But when I remember giving both of them these things to read, they had their names on them, and they both took them off and both said, no, you should have something with your own name. It looks better.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Nice.
And I think that's something that people really don't realize, the number of times that you have, there's a reason there's 3 and 4 people on a paper.
Sure.
When I see 17 on a paper, it kind of bugs me.
Yeah.
But then again, that's usually in things that I don't know how to do.
Yeah.
Pouring gels and stuff and all that kind of crap that, frankly, it might have taken 17 people to do.
Yeah. Identifying the genome of the songbird.
Yeah.
Yeah. There you go. That would probably take a few people.
I always get the impression that in some of these big labs, sometimes just, a guy walked by and they said, you want to be author 18? They go, yeah, okay, you can be author 18 in my next paper. So I have this sneaking suspicion.
Yeah,
but I think people don't get that when you see 3 and 4 authors, a lot of times that's, experiment 2 was done by author 1, experiment 3 was done by author 3, and the other two experiments, most of the write-up were done by the first author.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
When people get that.
Yeah.
Now is the time, and this is a pilot episode, so if you don't like this, people that are listening, both of you, let me know. But with apologies to my friends Scott and Tom on the Forecast podcast, who do 4 questions. They ask you 4 questions. I don't know if I'm going to have 4, but I've thought of a few. And these, I haven't told Lori what these are, and I just want you to answer them as honestly as you can. I think I'm going to call this section the PhD oral. So,
great.
Okay. What is the human applicability of your work?
Human applicability. Well, didn't you say you wanted me to answer this with one word?
It could be one word.
Oh, well, it can't be one word.
Yeah, or one sentence. But don't,
Well, the thing is that humans learn their vocalizations just like songbirds do. We know that humans, we come across problems with vocal communication in humans, be it stroke victims, autistic people. So perhaps if we can learn something from songbirds, we can apply that to humans.
Okay. What species have you not worked with that you'd want to work with?
Oh, gosh. There are so many. Let me pick one. It's going to have to be a corvid species, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just going to go with corvids. I'm just going to go
some
with
corvid.
A family, yes.
Okay, so,
yes.
So caught that a bit there, but
yeah,
that's fine.
Thank you, yeah.
if there was a fight between Ron Wiseman and Bill Roberts, we'll pick two guys that we both work with.
Mm.
Who would you take in that fight? Who would you put your money on?
Oh.
And I mean a fist fight.
Yeah. You know, I'm gonna go with Bill Roberts because he's a little bit taller.
He's wily.
I think he'd be a little quicker.
Well,
yeah.
Ron's kind of you know, he'd be bobbing and weaving, and he's tough, and he's kind of barrel chested, big guy.
Yeah.
But I think Bill's wily. He's wily.
He's wiry. Yeah.
Okay, that's good.
I think you get it done.
Okay. And the final question, if you didn't do animal cognition research, what kind of research would you do?
You know, I do have some interest in the languages. I don't know any other languages. Yeah, I took French when I was in high school. I'm very interested in the fact that some people are really good at learning second languages and third language and fourth languages.
Yeah.
I think I'd be interested to know if there's something different about them. So it'd still be a cognitive type of research area.
So you can go off into humanistic psychology or something.
Oh, no.
Oh, if you could all just see the look on Laurie's face.
No, it would still be cognition. It would still be, you know, higher cognitive abilities. It would it would be to do with language learning, probably language application in humans.
Well, thanks a lot, Laurie. If people want to get a hold of you, do you mind giving out your email address?
Yeah, no problem. It's, do you want me to spell it?
Laurie, L-A-U-R-I-E, right?
Perfect, yeah.
Dot Bloomfield, and you should be able to spell that. Bloom and Field. It's like something at algomau.ca. If you want to get a hold of me, I'm dave.broadbeck@algomau.ca. Please leave comments on the website, which right now will be at davebroadbeck.com. I'll eventually probably get a domain for this if this goes well. And let me know what you think. Follow me on Twitter at FDBroadbeck or on Facebook and Google+. Thanks, Laurie.
Thank you.